welcome to tonight's edition of Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and my compadre on engineering, Egberto Willis, on KPFT 90.1 FM Free Speech Radio, Community Free Speech Radio in Houston. Oh, my goodness. So much news to talk about that hopefully other people aren't, because otherwise I'm just a parrot. So I like to be a little different. I'm just funny that way. All right, one thing I wanted to point out just as kind of an opening, and the question I would ask is this a refinement or an escape clause? The new Google parent drops its explicit pledge not to do evil. That should concern you if it hasn't. Let's see, and I have a little bit of the article here. Alphabet, which took over as Google's new holding company on Friday, has dropped the tech giant's don't be evil mantra from its code of conduct. Quote, employees of Alphabet and its subsidiaries and controlled affiliates should do the right thing, follow the law, act honorably, and treat each other with respect, the new code reads, noticeably dropping the famous motto. And a little further down, it is noted, observers note that the break might be a way for the new rebranded company to differentiate itself from its former self and start off on a clean slate. Don't Be Evil had attracted its share of criticism for being ambiguous and potentially hypocritical. Alphabet's new code of conduct might be looking to attract new investments beyond its core search and advertising businesses, according to CNET. That is an article that I found in Fortune.com as repeated from Time magazine. Kind of interesting. So is this a clarification or is this a loophole that allows them to do evil as long as it's within the law? So apparently companies grow out of their goodness. Okay, so there's that. We do have local elections coming up. First Tuesday in November, I believe that's the 3rd. Now, we've talked about this. I will be talking about this. Now, let me just say, anecdotally, my experience in talking to callers on this show, and by the way, this is call-in today. You can call at 713-526-5738. And if you want to donate money, you can do that online at kpft.org. My impression has been that the listeners of this station, certainly the callers to this station, are consistent voters. So it's entirely possible that the information that I'll be spouting, giving, announcing over the next several weeks until Election Day, it's entirely possible that the listeners know this. So if you are a listener who already knows this, and if you are a listener who is already a dedicated voter, your job is to convince other people that this off-year election matters. Now, let me just give you an idea of what's going to be on the ballot. Now, you can go to harrisvotes.com or you can go to texasvotes.gov, and you can get information on early voting, dates, times, locations. I absolutely recommend early voting because not only does it mean you can vote anywhere during voting hours for those locations, you don't have to worry about where your precinct is. And on Election Day, they still haven't decided where the precinct locations are going to be. So if you want your vote to count and you want it to be easy and painless, early voting, absolutely the way to go. From October 19th to October 30th, early voting, 6 days a week, I believe, maybe. Egberto, is it open on Sundays? I don't recall. I think they have short hours.
Yeah, I don't have the schedule right now.
I actually may. No, not that one. I have my Batman utility belt. I've got my
phone
on
one side. Oh, my God. One of those, eh?
Yeah, I've got my old Palm TX on the other. And then I've got pens. Oh, my God, I'm such a nerd. Okay. Let's see what I got here. I'm going into my palm. I'm checking my calendar. Early voting. Okay, so early voting from October 19th to the 23rd, it's 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. On the 24th, which I think is a Saturday, it's 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. On the 25th, it's 1 p.m. to 6 p.m., and on the 26th through the 30th inclusive, it's 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. So given those days and given those hours, if you have any inclination to vote, those days and hours, if you want to vote, there's no way you can complain that you don't have enough access to early voting. You know, we're talking about 11 days. Some nights it's open until 6 or 7 p.m. Some days it opens as early as 7 a.m. You just can't say you couldn't find the time to vote. Now, let me give you an idea. What's on the ballot? You've got a Texas constitutional amendment election where you've got several propositions. You've got a Harris County and Harris County Flood Control District bond election, which has several propositions. You've got the City of Houston special election, which is Proposition 1, the HERO Amendment, which you want to vote yes on because you don't want any of your friends, neighbors, or relatives to be discriminated against. So it's just that simple. And then Charter Amendment 2, which I haven't had a chance to evaluate, but it says that the city charter, it's tiny and I have to get this close to my bad eyes. Okay, the city charter of the City of Houston shall be amended to reduce the number of terms of elective offices to no more than two terms in the same office and limit the length for all terms of elective office to 4 years beginning January 2016. Now, I don't know. Egberto, let me ask you a question. I know we are supposed to be, as much as possible, apolitical. We're not supposed to use, like, party endorsements.
We don't have to be apolitical, but we can't come and say, hey, we want you to vote X, Y, Z or anything.
All right, so, like, I can't tell people what I think they should do on a proposition.
Why not? I mean, you can give your personal opinion.
I would not necessarily want to do that for electoral candidates.
Right,
that,
not for
that
candidates.
That crosses a line. But yes. Propositions and amendments. Okay.
That's a value statement.
Okay, so City of Houston special election, Proposition 1, the HERO Amendment. Unless you like discriminating against friends, family, or neighbors, you want to vote yes on that proposition. This other charter amendment, I haven't examined it, but just what it says, I think it's really stupid enough to vote no. I can't think of anything more stupid than only having people in office who don't know what they're doing, and then if you have people in office who know what they're doing, they're term limited out. You know, the argument about term limits is we have term limits. They're called elections.
Thank you. That is the smartest thing I've heard. I
wish I could say that I came up with it.
But, I mean, I'm yet to hear somebody give a good... I mean, the term limits argument makes you feel good. Oh, get those bombs out. Well, I may not want my bomb out of there.
Well, you know, the concept of term limits really took hold from FDR. FDR was elected for four consecutive presidential terms. He broke the Washington precedent. No other president had ever gotten a third term, let alone a fourth. After Roosevelt died, there was a strong movement, mostly initially from Republicans, to limit the number of presidential terms. And, I mean, you can see some justification for that. When you have a guy serving 16 years, for most people, that's practically president for life. So,
if that's what the folks want.
I think that at some levels, you may want to have term limits because power corrupts. But in any case, I think when you start talking about city government, if you're going to have term limits, which mainly term limits are what elections are for, but if you're going to have term limits, I think that 4 years is a ridiculously short time. People learn their jobs, and in many cases, it takes a year before you even know what you're doing, and it can take several years before you become good at it, and then you're term limited out? I don't know. But anyhow, so getting back to the crux of what I wanted to say, this off-year election, which typically gets 10 to 15% turnout. The entire city government is up for election. So we've got here, let me just get to the city election part. Okay, we've got the mayor. We've got the various district council members. We've got all the at-large city council members, and we have the city controller. Basically, everybody who runs the freaking city is up for election. Now, some people may call that an off-year election. Personally, I call that the second most important election you can have, short of electing your president and your senators and your congresspeople. This is a critical election. This will affect your daily life more than Ted Cruz, more than John Cornyn, and more than Barack Obama. This election is a critical election. And, you know, it's technically nonpartisan. So it's not like we've had a primary and then we have like a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, and a Green. It's nothing like that. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We have 13 mayoral candidates, basically a guaranteed runoff situation. You've got Demetrius Smith. I know nothing about most of these people, by the way. Demetrius Smith, Ben Hall, Victoria Lane, Sylvester Turner, Adrian Garcia, Bill King, Rafael Munoz Jr., Marty McVeigh. Makes me think of a movie. Steve Costello, Joe Ferreira, Hoc Thai Nguyen, Chris Bell, and Dale Steffes. That's just the mayoral slate. Then you've got, now this is from my sample ballot from where I live. You've got three people running for city council in District C. You've got, it looks like, seven people running for at-large one. You've got five people running for at-large two. You've got four people running for at-large three. You've got seven people running for at-large four. And you've got four people running for at-large five. And then you've got the city controller. I challenge you to tell me when an election is more important than that. If we don't get even a pathetic 35% turnout, that is a pathetic turnout, by the way, but at least that's a standard off-year turnout, like the second year between presidential elections. If we don't get at least 35% turning out to make these choices, we should be incredibly ashamed as a city, as a county, as a state. Critical, critical election. Your life, in many ways, literally depends on this election. Okay, I'm going to do a quick ID and then I'm going to get to Scott. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I've got my co-pilot here, Egberto Willis. He has his own show, Politics Done Right, Thursdays from 3 to 4. And this is Free Speech Radio, your community radio station. So, Scott, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
Thank you. I've decided to vote against Proposition 2 because I'm active in two political organizations. I like having an election for them every year. In Houston, you have an election every year. City elections every odd-numbered year, and state and federal, even-numbered years.
Yeah. But yeah. But the question is, no more than 4 years.
Oh, okay.
Here's what I'm just going to read it again.
Yeah.
Change the city charter of Houston so it's amended to reduce the number of terms of elective offices to no more than two in the same office, and limit the length for all terms of elective office to 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. It gives anybody a maximum of 8 years in office, and that's they're given two 4-year terms rather than 3 2-year terms. That's
now,
the change.
Are you speaking from knowledge? Because that's not how I read it.
Oh, well.
What it says, I'm going to go again, it says reduce the number of terms of office, elective office, to no more than two in the same office.
Yeah.
And to limit the length for all terms of elective office to four. Oh, I see what you're saying. So if you read it the other way, if there is an office that has a 4-year term, you're saying that that suggests you can do two 4-year terms. I might argue that it's ambiguous.
So, you know, well, I think it is. Now, it doesn't tell, my impression is that all elections are going, all offices will be up for election in the same year. So you would have city elections in every other odd-numbered year.
You know, And I mean, I guess it really, on some level, doesn't matter if we both agree on how we would vote on this particular amendment, but we're not precisely on the same page as to why. You know, I have a saying that it doesn't matter why you agree on something as long as you agree. You don't have to agree for the same reason. So that's fine. I think, though, that, you know, we do get ballot fatigue. I think one of the reasons that we get such low turnouts in non-presidential elections and criminally low turnouts in so-called off-year elections, too many freaking elections. Now, on the one hand, I can appreciate wanting to keep the ballot to a reasonable length. You know, if you go to a statewide sample ballot, 12 pages. 12 pages. I was thinking of printing it out until I saw it was 12 pages, because that's all the different state propositions and county propositions and this kind of stuff. But, you know, I don't see a reason why the mayoral, why the city elections can't be the same years as congressional elections. And give people a year off so that voting is something they can look forward to, instead of voting being something like, oh, crap, and another, sorry about that. It's like, oh, Jiminy, another election coming up. Now it's like the bond election is here, and the primary election is there, and the congressional election, you know, and the runoff election. It just gets to be too much.
What are organizations going to do in non-election years?
Well, they might try increasing voter turnout during election years.
Well, yeah.
Registering people, non-suppressing the vote, getting people excited about the fewer elections that we have, because you only get this opportunity every 2 years, and then you get a rest, and then you can get excited again instead of every three freaking months.
I don't believe I get excited by elections. I am just plain committed to them. I've missed only about two or three elections in the last 50 years. Consider it a job to do.
I agree. And, you know, in some parts of the country, that is considered more of, let's say, a mission than in other parts. When you go into, like, the Northeast, people are brought up to vote. I mean, you have heavier turnouts. People are brought up to vote. And as you get away from the Northeast, turnouts go down, partly because population density goes down, dedication to the franchise goes down, voter apathy, voter ballot, what's the term I just used, ballot fatigue, you know, all of these different things. I think you need to make it a little more special. What if we had Christmas every other month?
Oh, that would be expensive.
But I would like it.
You would only like it for a few months. And it's like, oh, my God, I have to go shopping again? So, anyway.
Oh, I don't find an election every year too much of a burden.
But it's not just one. Generally, it's several elections a
year. Okay, you have, in an odd-numbered year in Houston, you have a November election and then a runoff, usually a runoff. And even-numbered years, you generally have at least have three elections. You have a primary or primary runoff and a general election.
I don't know. It just seems to me like too many. You know what, Scott? If you don't mind, I would like to go to another caller, because it looks like we're getting some activity here. But I thank you very much
for calling. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. You take care. Bye. We do have open lines. The phone number is 713-526-5738. This is actually open forum. We started off talking about elections. I may talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, depending on how things go. But it's open forum. So if there's something you've thought of that I haven't that would make an interesting topic, please let me know. Okay, Brad is next up. Brad, thank you for calling. You're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
All right, so if you're saying that it will basically, you can have for city council no more than 2 4-year terms for that position, city council, correct?
Actually, we were rereading that, me and Scott, and it's a little ambiguous.
Because so I can run and win in District C, and then after 8 years, I can then go to at-large position one, 8 years, and at large position two for 8 years, and so on and so on and so on, right?
Well, I think city council is 2 years. And I guess in theory, perhaps you could do that. But I don't know because, you know, the amendment proposition isn't really clear the way it's framed on the ballot.
That's the case, why should you vote for something if you don't know what it means?
There you go. That's what we're saying. So I think that that's an automatic no vote. But here's a thing that I think we need to consider. You know, there's always the mentality of throw the bums out. But if you think about how long it takes you to get your feet under you in any new job, and then how much longer it takes you before you feel you're good at it, I'll just give you an example. When I became a window covering installer, I would say for the first year, I was very uncomfortable in terms of my knowledge and capability at the job. I knew there was a lot I didn't know. It took me 2 years before I began to feel comfortable that except for stuff that I had to learn because it was new, that I had the basics pretty much down. Now, if there was a term limit on being a drapery installer, at the end of 2 years, just when I had gotten good at it, I'd be term limited out. And that's true of many different occupations. And, you know, politics, when you start getting into government with parliamentary rules and obscure rules about getting things done and the relationships you have to build, I'm not saying there's no corruption. I'm not saying that people don't get too full of power. But there is this aspect of, do you want to really term limit them out just when they've learned their jobs?
Well, look at this. Ever since we've had term limits for the city of Houston, how many political scandals have we had in that same time period? Look at the county level. There's no term limits. Look at Jerry Eversole, Jack Aversia, Victor Trevino, those other black constables where the city attorney should have gone after them, but since they're all Democrats, didn't. You know,
I will say this. You make a point. So maybe there has to be a balance in between no term limits and somebody can be commissioner for life, essentially, or until they're arrested, or, you know, term limits that are so short that you term limit people out of their jobs by the time they're first getting good at doing them. And, you know, they've learned the ropes and they've learned how the levers of power work. And if they want to get good things done, maybe I'm being a little too optimistic here, but if they want to get good things done, now they've learned after the first 2 or 3 years how to actually do that. And now they're term limited out. Egberto is dying to say something here.
Yeah, I refuse to accept that somehow when you say that you want term limits, you're saying those people who are voting for term limits are going to decide in the future that other people don't have the right to keep the particular candidate or the particular person they want in office. That is not democracy. Not only that, having term limits actually say, I know for a fact that people are stupid. And I don't believe that. I believe that if we have good media and if we have a Mike Honig on the radio exposing folk, that we can actually have a real democracy. I think we a lot of times fight the what is it? Help me out here, Mike. We don't fight the underlying problem, but we fight
the superficial.
And I think term limits is fighting the superficial.
Well, let me first say this. There is an old saying that ignorance is a correctable condition. Only stupid is forever. I don't think most people are stupid. I think there's a great deal of ignorance. And you know, one story that I tell a lot because I think it's sort of symptomatic, we have and I've told it before, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. We have a multi-billion-dollar, multi-decadal commitment to light rail. Light rail was defeated in this city time after time after time after time. Ballot fatigue, okay? They finally got this thing passed in an off-year election. Maybe it was a special election. I don't recall specifically. What I do recall is that it was an election with 10% turnout. So this multi-billion dollar, multi-decadal commitment that changed the face of our city, in some ways not for the better, it was approved by a majority of 10% of the voters. Where were the other 90%? I voted. You know, maybe you voted. But 90% of eligible voters didn't show up. The term limit problem, as I see it, it's an appealing proposition because people don't show up to vote. If people showed up to vote, then elections would be term limits.
Exactly. So, I mean, that light rail thing that eventually passed, you call it voter fatigue. I say, look, that's what the people wanted. If they don't want it, they could have stopped it.
It's the
Umberto, I have a question for you. But every time it seems like anywhere in the country where when term limits are, people are allowed to vote on it, they always vote for it. So, but you're against people voting for it.
No,
is
that true?
Term limits. Am I correct?
I don't think term limits has always passed.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't, you know, maybe you know something that I don't, sir. But I mean, the thing about it is I think it's, I mean, if people vote for term limits, it is fine, right? But what's happening is you're voting to curtail the rights of others down the line in the future. So, I mean, it's how do you get around having even a term limit? To me, that should be something that's unconstitutional.
It's the equivalent of an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in. So it's like you go to a website and you're automatically included unless you opt out. So you're automatically included in this term limit scheme unless you vote to opt out. So if you depend on people's apathy or laziness, you'll never lose. Would you agree with that, Jay?
Well, I look at it, the ones that have the money are the ones that keep getting elected over and over and over.
Well, there is some of that, yeah.
But that's what that is what Mike is doing here, right, Mike?
One of the things that I hope to do through my show is just make people think about issues in ways that they don't necessarily think about them. So anything I can do that makes someone go,
exactly.
I've done my job.
That's a reason for that is a reason for KPFT. That is a reason for Think Wing Radio, right? I mean, we want to have radio shows where what you just said, sir, I'm speaking to
Jay,
right? What you just said, Jay, the idea is we want to make sure that people are educated, or I don't like to use educated because sometimes it's condescending,
informed.
Because I think our biggest problem right now in society is that people are not informed. They're force-fed what the plutocracy wants them to be fed.
Ignorance is a correctable condition.
You just said that.
Whoops. Okay. So apparently we finally bored Jay. Oh, who was that? Was that Jay? Are you there? No, that was Jay. Jay was a hang-up. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM, free speech radio in Houston, your community radio station. You can support it at kpft.org. I'm here with Egberto Willis, who has his own show Thursdays 3 to 4 p.m., Politics Done Right here. Maybe it's politics, maybe it ain't. We just change it up. Okay, so we have open lines, 713-526-5738. Jay, I think, has hung up on us or got disconnected. Jay, you there? No, he's gone. Okay, so we're up to Alex. Alex, you're on the air. Thank you for waiting. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. What's on your mind?
So I liked one thing you just said a moment ago, that you like the purpose of your station is to make people think about the politics and things in a way that they haven't before.
That's
and
horrible.
I've been listening for a little while now. You just did that earlier with me. You mentioned when you were talking to someone earlier that you don't see why local elections couldn't coincide the year with congressional elections or presidential so that people won't have to go out and vote as often, right?
Basically, think about ways to combat voter fatigue so that people who might be more inclined to vote less often have that, don't feel like they're constantly being battered with elections. Because I sometimes feel that way.
Right, right. So let me pose this to you. And I'm no expert. I've just been listening. And I just want to play devil's advocate because I'm curious what you have to say to this.
All right.
Do you think that an argument could be made for if, you know, every time we have elections, whether it's local, national, whatever, think about all the commercials we see, all the media time that gets devoted to that. Do you think that having local elections and presidential elections and all of that together will be inhibiting people from becoming more informed because they're not going to have the media time to do all the research and learn about all of these candidates, whereas when you have elections spaced out, they get the time to consider each of them differently, you know what I mean?
You know, I appreciate your raising that point because it's an issue that we all have to address when we have long down-ballot races. And you know, we talk about the governor and the mayor and the senator and maybe the attorney general and maybe the city controller. And if you pay attention to those races, when you start to get below that, when you start getting to the judges and the city council members and the various other local officials for precincts and parts of the city and whatnot.
Right.
It's almost literally impossible to figure out who you would want to vote for if you knew about the candidates. And that becomes, in my opinion, the value of endorsements. Now, do I blindly follow endorsements? Like this guy has 47 endorsements and this guy has 13. No, I don't do that. But given my particular political proclivities, what I'll do is I'll generally go to maybe a couple of union sites and see what they're doing. And I'll go to a couple of newspapers and see who they're suggesting. And I'll tell you what, I go to the LGBT caucus because what I have found, I actually did this for 4 or 5 years before it dawned on me that I was actually giving more weight to the GLBT than I was to some extent to the others. And when you think about it, it makes a certain sense. Even if you're a straight person, what do the LGBTs stand for? They stand for personal rights, personal privacy, equality before the law. If those are issues that matter to you, their endorsements should be considered.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So, I mean, I find this mix of places that I go, you know, that aren't determinedly left and aren't determinedly right, and I look at the endorsements, and if they have a little statement, I'll read the little statement. And that gives me a way of judging where I should put my vote for the down ballot races. Essentially, I'm letting someone else do the work for me in terms of the digestion of information, and then I look at what they've digested. It's kind of like a Reader's Digest for a voter.
I like that, and I think something that's important to just anywhere you go, anywhere in the world, it's important to be informed with both sides. And not, you know, I see so many people who, you know, I'm only going to vote left or I'm only going to vote right because they feel that they have to choose one side or the other, that it's very black and white, when in fact it's a spectrum. There's such a gray area in the middle where people, you know, took the time to listen to different sources, like you were saying, and get to hear more things. They might find that, you know, they agree with a particular party when it comes to some issues, but, you know, are vehemently opposed to it when it comes to another. It all plays into the importance of being informed about politics in the world. And, you know, that we as a society need to do something to help counteract the apathy that we are finding right now, because there's a lot of apathy. A lot of young people are just distracted by entertainment and sports, and not that I don't love the two of those things, but you need to be able to prioritize times and know, you know, when you should be paying attention more to one thing than just the TV show that you're going to watch that night. You know what I mean?
Well, what really aggravates me is when I hear that old saw that both parties are the same, what difference does it make? You know, there may have been a time when there was some truth to that. There's always been a difference between Democrats and Republicans. But in my lifetime, I used to consider myself very much a moderate, a centrist, where I definitely leaned left on social issues, and I sort of leaned right on things like economics and military issues. And my feeling is I call myself the most conservative liberal at the station because I don't really feel like my core political and social inclinations have changed. I feel like the center has moved right, making me look a whole lot more left than I really think that I am. Although, you know, I'm socialist on some things and very capitalist on others. But I think that the key, and it's what you're saying as well, is not to depend on one source of information. You know, I'm a Democrat. I pretty much vote straight Democrat. There have been exceptions over the years, fewer now. There is at least one justice of the peace who is a Republican that if he was in my district, I would vote for him. I think he's a terrific justice of the peace. But I think that if all you read is the Chronicle, if all you listen to is Fox News, if all you listen to is one of the right-wing talk show stations, you know, I go to Google News, which is an aggregator. There are other aggregators. And I have found myself going to places like the Irish Times and the Hindu Times and Chinese Central Television News and You know, there are some news sources that you know are so biased and just lie. You know, Al Jazeera, I think, is a more reliable source of news than Fox. At least Al Jazeera America.
Al Jazeera is the most reliable source of news for America than most American papers, but they're not a good reliable source for anything in the Middle East.
Well, but they report on the Middle East in an alternative way. First of all, most Western news media don't really get into the Middle East. I mean,
right.
They report superficially, as you were saying, what's going on the surface. But all of this superficial stuff, there's depth behind it. There's thousands of years of history. There are cultural differences and religious differences and geographical differences. And Al Jazeera, because that's where they're from, even though they're Al Jazeera America, they tend to give you a little bit more information. Now, Farsi News, I don't even listen to Farsi News. Farsi News is just the Iranian Fox. Okay? And there are news sources like that. But you sort of learn which sources. Chinese CCTV, Chinese Central Television, pro-Chinese, government-owned news station. What I like about them, though, is their propaganda is obvious, and their pro-Chinese tilt is obvious, but they still report on things going on where the information is the information, and it's in places that normally we don't hear much about, or it's a perspective, and the Chinese have a perspective, and, you know, whether you're a loyal American or some other persuasion, there are other sides to an argument. You know, the whole Chinese territorial thing. I'm pro-American. I think the Chinese are overstepping, being over-aggressive, but some of their arguments are not crazy.
Saying there's always another side to an argument is good, too, because with, you know, whatever your news source is, if you watch the news and you watch CNN or you watch Fox or you know, if you watch The Daily Show or prefer the Internet, you know, whatever it is, I find so many people who, I only watch Fox or I only watch CNN because of which way they lean. And I think that's fine, but even for people who are so, you know, opinionated and set in their mentality, I think that it would be beneficial for them to look at the other side for what you're saying, because there are always two or more than two opinions on an issue. And they can, I don't think if they're so certain that, oh yeah, Fox is always right, or oh, CNN is always right, watching another news source would allow them to reinforce their own views, so they would have more to talk about that they hear other people saying. But when you only listen to the same two channels, you're not, you know, it's like looking at, I heard an astronomer saying this somewhere the other day on the radio, I don't remember what, how we think we know so much about the universe and the planets and other places when we're only here on Earth in our own little solar system. It's when you need to gather perspective.
We have a sample of one. When you're talking about the solar system, I mean, they're trying to learn, but in terms of our best sample, we have a sample of one.
Yeah, it's just the idea that, you know, if you're looking at an island from one side, you can make as many inferences about the island and its depth and what you can't see, but you're going to learn more as you go around the island and above it and see it. And this is just a metaphor to, you know, for people when it comes to politics in the world, you need to hear what other people have to say. And I think for that reason, it's good listening to other stations, whether it's Al Jazeera or a Chinese news station. I like that, you know, you're promoting people wanting to listen to other news stations other than the main ones that they see in front of them every day.
You know, even if you listen to like NBC, CBS, ABC, they don't have bad news organizations. If you look at Reuters or Associated Press or UPI or Agence Française, they report good news. But at the end of the day, editors make news decisions about what goes on a page or in a paper. And writers, no matter how journalistically objective they try to be, cannot help but bring a point of view to their story. And even when you have good professional reportage, the fact is you can't really get a picture of the news unless you go to other good sources. And then you start to see a preponderance of the evidence, so to speak. I'll give you an interesting example. I talked briefly about the China, South and East China Sea situation. From an American standpoint, we see them as being very aggressively expansionist. The Chinese, though, they make a number of points. You know, disputed territory is disputed for a reason. But here's an interesting point that they make. They said that until other countries around them began changing the territorial status quo, they basically observe the territorial status quo. And I have to say, in the long term, if you look at it, that's essentially true. There were two precipitating factors that started making, or at least giving them the excuse, if not the reason, to suddenly get very aggressive in territorial claims. The first one was there were some islands in the South China Sea that had been privately owned by a Japanese person or company. And that person or company sold those islands to the Japanese government. So the islands were effectively nationalized. A similar thing happened with the Philippines, I think it was, where there were some little islands that were disputed, and the Filipinos decided to put a presence there. And the Chinese say, well, you know, that's all of a sudden we see other countries around us changing the status quo. We're not going to sit around while they're encroaching on our claims, disputed or otherwise. Now, you could argue the Chinese overreacted. You can argue a lot of different things. But their basic one, that particular basic argument is not a crazy argument. It's historically true. They had not done anything until the Japanese nationalized those islands, and that changed everything. They complained bitterly about that.
Well, and that makes sense, too. If they were, like you were saying, if they were kind of sitting around for a while watching other countries change their policies, that, you know, instead of jumping right into it, they were kind of looking at what the long-term cause and effect would be, and then they could say, you know what, we don't want to lose some of our claims.
Precisely.
We want to do something about it to preserve them.
So as an American, I can say I don't want the Chinese taking over the vast majority of the South and East China Seas and the Sea of Japan. As an American, I can say that. But if you look at it objectively, not all their arguments are crazy. They have an argument about the Treaty of San Francisco, where the Republic of China and Taiwan signed an agreement having to do with some territory swapping with Japan and whatnot. And the Chinese claim, the mainland Chinese, the PRC, they're saying, they're not the legitimate government. We were the legitimate government when that treaty was signed, so we don't recognize it. Now, you can argue about it, but it does create grounds for a dispute. So, you know, disputed is, it's not always a crazy thing where they're just saying we owned that land 1,000 years ago, and therefore it's ours, which is also some of the claims they sometimes make. But some of the claims are not crazy.
No, not at all. Hey, you know, thank you so much for having me on here. I actually need to go right now, but I think... the main theme that I like that we've just been talking about is perspective. I think anyone listening to this right now, just wherever you go in life, whether it's politics or whatever, when it comes to working with other people, and, you know, everyone has opinions about things, it's all about gathering perspective. If you are so sure that your opinion is right and your opinion is better, then what do you have to lose by considering someone else and letting them say what they want to say? You know?
I think
that's something that we can all, you know, with us wherever we go.
We should all risk being confused by the facts.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling, Alex. I've enjoyed it. You take care. Okay, we have open lines, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and my engineer and compadre, Egberto Willis. And he has his own show, Politics Done Right, Thursdays from 3 to 4. I am here Mondays from 9 to 10. My website, by the way, is thinkwingradio.com. Or if you're a little lazy, you can do thinkwing.org. It doesn't require quite as much typing. Let's see. One of the things that I wanted to talk about also, I mean, the elections are really, really important. I want to talk a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. It's back in the news. Hillary Clinton has, I believe, come out against it now. She had been arguing for it as Secretary of State, but of course, you know, she's part of an administration at that point. So now she's decided as a candidate for president, she has decided to come to a different place. Here's the thing about the TPP, and I don't know whether I'm for it or against it, but I always hear it framed basically in two or maybe three terms. It's bad for workers. It's good for corporations, or it's just American policy, and we don't know why they do it, but they do it. Free trade, blah, blah, blah. Free trade, fair trade is another argument. Here's a thing I don't hear talked about much. The TPP is not only about whether it's good or bad for American jobs, and the AFL-CIO is against it. And it's not just about whether it's good for big corporations. It probably is, or they wouldn't be fighting for it. It is also about geopolitical influence. And it's not so different from what the United States did after the Second World War by creating very, very strong economic ties with Western Europe and with coastal Asia. Economic ties are the equivalent in some ways of military influence. So the TPP is at least partly one of the reasons that the American government is so eager to have this Trans-Pacific partnership. It ties Japan to us more strongly economically. It ties the Philippines. It ties Malaysia. I think it even ties Vietnam. It takes all of those countries on the Western Pacific Rim, Western for us, and ties them to us economically in a way that sort of denies China influence over them. Is this a policy of containment or a policy of encirclement? They don't call it that. I think there's some truth to that, and I think when the Chinese complain about it, there's some validity to that. But it's really important to think about, it's not just about good or bad for jobs, it's not just about good or bad for corporations, it's also about geopolitical smarts and geopolitical influence, who's going to be in control of essentially the world in the 21st century. Is it going to be the United States or some Western power? Is it going to be China or Russia or some Eastern power? We are living at a very peculiar time, an almost unique time, very rare in history, between empires. The Soviet Union collapsed. We used to have a bipolar world. And a bipolar world, there were still wars, but essentially everybody kind of picked a side and knew where they stood. And now, because the Soviet Union has collapsed, Russia is fighting to reestablish its power. China now has the wealth and certainly the population and technology to exercise its growing influence. India also sees China as both a trading partner and a potential threat. So India now is also expanding its fleet of submarines. I think it's trying to get aircraft carriers. It's got destroyers. They're starting to get more influential in the Indian Ocean. So you've got this jockeying for power at what you might call an inter-imperial period. And it's a very dangerous time. And sometimes it takes a war to settle everybody's ambitions so that everybody understands exactly where they stand. So the TPP is part of this process. Should it be negotiated in a way that is as good for American workers as possible? Totally. Should it be negotiated in a way that encourages domestic production, manufacturing? Yes. Manufacturing is where national power comes from. You can't order arms from China when you're fighting a war with them. Okay? Just doesn't make sense. You've got to have industrial power. Gary got tired of waiting for me. Sorry about that, Gary. You can call back. I think it's important to think about the TPP and agreements like it in broader terms than just, is it good for me as a worker? Is it bad for me as a worker? Or is it just about greedy corporations? Like, Berto, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of upsetting to me, actually, TPP. We constantly do things from a corporate point of view. In other words, we make sure corporations are taken care of first. And if some good trickle down around, and by the way, you're correct that it's also geopolitical, right? Mm-hmm. And what you said about it, I believe in that, you know, tiny economies make it more difficult for folks to fight among each other. So happened, though, that there's never a chance that we were going to fight Vietnam again or the Philippines or any of these weak Pacific
rim. No, but weirdly, they're now becoming, if not allies, at least partners.
Well, actually,
pushed together by China's aggressiveness.
And my contention would be that they've become our slave labor force, which brings down the American. In other words, I mean, there's
the race to the bottom.
Right. There is no mathematical formula in which having Vietnamese working at under a dollar an hour for manufacture, all it does is it ensures that we have a deficient manufacturing base in America. And I think it's a national security threat.
Absolutely.
And in as much as it's a national...
We don't want China to be the arsenal for democracy.
Which is what...
is what they are right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. And the interesting thing about it then is China has taken a different approach, and it's not advertised here. Because we don't want, but what China has done as well is when China goes to Panama or China goes to Colombia or China goes to Nigeria or China goes to Uganda or all these places, they're out there building roads. And so people see a different they see a different work method with another country, which involves, I am seeing infrastructure built in my country. I am seeing these other things done in my country. In America, we create treaties that's based on capital, and we make sure that capital is first protected, and then we worry about everything else.
Well, at the end of the day, money, as they used to say in a New York commercial for a clothing store, money talks, nobody walks, okay? But I think you're missing an important point, which is that when we talk about foreign aid, people have a fundamental misconception of what foreign aid is. They think we just give money to a country and then they do stuff with it. There is always one, at least one big string, and that is to the maximum extent possible, they use American contractors, American flagged transport, American products are purchased. So I would say, just ballparking it, and I may be wrong in the actual number, but let's say 80 or 90% of those dollars that the U.S. gives as foreign aid end up coming back to the United States as job-creating and profit-creating purchases.
That is where you are the most conservative liberal at KPFP.
But it's true. And
no,
the
it's
Chinese
not.
Are, yes, it is. And the Chinese are doing the exact same
thing.
Let
me tell you what I mean by that. Let's take the Iraq War as an example. When Iraq.
The who?
The Iraq War. The war in Iraq. Okay, as an example. I'm just using that as an example because I can quantify it. We took the monies out of the Defense Department to make private companies take care of it, and private companies maximize their profits in whatever they do. And what they did then is not bring the monies particularly back to Americans to work the jobs, but they gave it to foreigners in these different countries that would work for less.
Well, it was a mixture.
Right. And
some of the more highly skilled jobs were Americans were imported.
Yes.
And
yes.
For some of the jobs, they used locals.
No doubt.
But
no.
The money went to American companies.
Right.
Which then brought the money, in most cases, back to the United States, paid taxes on it, blah, blah, blah. Or avoided taxes on it, blah,
right.
blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
One or the other. But I think it's important to understand, like, once on, it might have been on KPFT, it might have been on Democracy Now!, and there was someone who was saying that they were very upset about American aid, that it requires that anything shipped from the United States as part of that aid has to go on American-flagged vessels. Why doesn't it go on Chinese-flagged vessels, which are so much cheaper? And they're missing the point. The point is that it's not only a political move, it's not only an economic move, but it's the only way you would even get people to agree to foreign aid
right.
is if the money came back to the United States. So granted, you could probably get Chinese ships cheaper, but you wouldn't get the foreign aid.
Right. But I just think that you think it's a bit more altruistic than it is.
As, oh, no, I don't have illusions about it.
Okay, because
I mean, a little bit. A little bit it's altruistic.
Yeah, but what I mean is,
but it's about politically and economically tying them to the United States.
I agree partially, but I think the part that I don't agree with is that I think it is, while it comes back to America, 100, you're right, a lot of it comes back to America.
Most of it.
Or I'm not going to say that.
We don't know a percentage.
Yeah,
most of it is designed to come back.
Okay, I don't know that. But let's say that's the case. It is still coming back into the hands of a very few.
Well, I mean, that's the nature of the capitalist society we live in today, because corporations are people.
And that is a whole thing. You just answered the big question, and that is a whole reason why we have to have a change, because mathematically speaking, it is unsustainable. I heard Clinton say something that got me real upset yesterday when he was talking at his.
You're talking about Bill then?
Bill Clinton, yeah. Where he said that, well, you know, Europe is a lot more socialistic than America. And what he said is, Europe could, if Europe wants to foment more growth, it'll have to reduce its socialism, if you will, okay? And what they fail to understand is these guys love to speak about growth, growth, growth. Exponential growth is simply not sustainable.
No, it is not.
And the truth of the matter is the growth that he speaks about, that he'd like to see more growth, let's say, in Europe or in America, is at the expense of India, is at the expense of Philippines and all these other places based on the current economic model that we have?
You know, it was either, I think, Mark Twain or Will Rogers who said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. And I think there was once a great example, Ted Koppel, who I think is one of the great reporters and interviewers of all time. Ted Koppel once had on a Sandinista government person, or government in exile. And the Sandinista was saying, and the United States has increased their presence in Nicaragua by 50%. And Ted Koppel said, well, I think they went from 40 to 60, or from 100 to 150. And the guy says, but that's 50%. And Ted Koppel said, yeah, but it sounds a lot less impressive that way. So statistics are highly manipulable. And I don't have any doubt that right now we're living in an era that's the equivalent of the late 19th century robber baron era. Overpaid executives is not a victimless crime. I mean, technically it's not a crime, but metaphorically it is not a victimless crime. It's a crime that comes out of consumers and the prices they pay. It's a crime that comes out of wages from the workers that they don't get. And I'll tell you two reasons why I think that we need, and we're running out of time here, and gee, I've been talking enough so I didn't need many callers as it happened, and some of them hung up on me, and I apologize for that. But I believe we need a stronger industrial base for two reasons. One, we need to be able to manufacture military equipment in the event of war. You know, Buick and Chevrolet and Ford, I mean, we're not even talking the usual military contractors. They were, during the Second World War, they were making airplanes, they were making rifles and handguns, and, you know, we need factories. Now, here's the other thing. We are constantly talking about re-educating and retraining workers. Okay, we have to teach them how to survive in the modern service-oriented economy. And you know what? There was, I think it was, Santorum, where I think he said that, he commented that Barack Obama said that everybody should be able to get a college degree. And Santorum's comment was, what a snob, okay? That's a stupid comment. But I think the thing to remember is not everybody has the mindset or the talents to suddenly become a software engineer or a computer service technician. You know, some people, what they're good at is building things. What they're good at is working on a factory line. That's one of the reasons that we need factories. Okay, I'm out of time. I talk too much. Thank you so much for listening. Thank the callers who called in. I enjoyed it. You've been listening to ThinkWing Radio on KPFT 90.1. I am Mike Honig. My engineer is Egberto Willis. And remember, if your vote didn't count, they wouldn't try so hard to suppress it. And make sure you get out there and vote in about 3-4 weeks. Take care.
On Thursday, October 22nd, you can join San Jose Clinic at their Fall Speaker Series luncheon for a unique conversation about the power of collaboration. Dr. Robert Robbins, President and CEO of the Texas Medical Center, will lead a panel discussion on healthcare executives as they examine how we can provide the safety net together. You can visit sanjoseclinic.org or call 713-490-2620 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at KPFT Houston.